the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup, goalkeeper Lydia Williams, alongside teammate Claire Polkinghorne, became the first Australian footballer, man or woman, to play at five FIFA World Cups. Lydia is a proud Noongar woman who was born in Katanning in Western Australia, but lived most of her childhood years in Kalgoorlie, a small town northeast of Perth, before moved with her family to Canberra. In 2022, she became the first female goalkeeper to register 100 caps for Australia and just the second Indigenous player to do so after Kaya Simon a few months earlier. On top of an incredible Matildas resume, she's had an extensive career overseas with clubs including Arsenal and Paris Saint-Germain. I absolutely loved the chance to sit down and chat with Lydia. She's really calm and composed and has a real warmth about her, and she reflects beautifully not only on her career to date, but on the legacy she hopes to leave, in particular for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids. I hope you enjoy this one as much as I did. Lydia Williams, welcome to the Female Athlete Project.
Well, thank you for having me. This is exciting.
This is exciting. I'm actually really glad we've been able to line this up, and in person as well is always really nice.
Yeah.
You've recently had ankle surgery.
Mm-hmm.
How is it tracking, and how are you feeling mentally as well about the rehab?
So far, so good. I mean, I think when you get a little bit older, joints tend to not be as happy with you with the kind of abuse that you put through them. But it was a little bit of a treasure hunt. Got some good floating pieces of bone and bits out.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of like a good 6 to 8 week turnaround, and just making sure, I think it's given me some time to focus on other things outside of just performing,
mm-hmm.
Which is nice. You don't really get too much of that when you're in season, I think.
What are we talking other things?
Oh, just like, you know, like a lot more like upper body, like tendon strength in your shoulders,
right.
Or real heavy lifting in the gym. We don't really do that too much during season because you don't want to be fatigued for on the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
I've been able to start doing a little bit more heavier stuff to actually feel sore the next day.
And I imagine for you guys, because I think like if I compare it to where we're at with AFLW, we play 10 weeks of the year and we almost have like a 9-month preseason.
Lovely.
Which I feel like there's benefits, there's pros and cons to each scenario, but you guys seem to play a lot, right? And a lot is back to back, and then you've got your international windows.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's not a lot of time, I imagine, to get on top of things like that.
No, not absolutely not. And especially like with you balancing, I guess, you know, European football, if you're over there, and national team, you really only get maybe 1 month before the season starts, and usually that's tactical. You're coming during tactical time and how the team is feeling, a little bit of pre-season testing, running, gym, but you really don't get like a bulk of, you know, three months of let's lift, let's just go heavy with strength stuff and really hard on fitness aspects. So it's really almost like a balancing act throughout your whole career, really, unless you either aren't a part of a national team or decide to go to a different club and their season is a little bit different than mm-hmm. most of Europe.
So are you saying when you come back, we're going to see you looking swole?
Huge. Guns. I like been doing something for 2 weeks. I'm like, oh, my biceps are growing a little bit. This is exciting. Yeah.
You've got a big hoodie on, so I can't see, but I'm backing you in here.
I'm not going to flex or anything like that.
It's interesting, this discussion around the injury piece, and I've had a bit of a rough run. I'm in a good patch now. I'm touching wood.
But
it is this, like, mentally it's quite interesting, and even the fact that that was one of the first things you went to, right? Like, I feel like as an elite athlete, there's this element of always having to find, this sucks, I'm missing out on X, Y, Z, but what am I going to do to get better and to create more longevity in my body or perform better overall?
Yeah, I think it's always like your profession or like what you are meant to do is perform on the pitch and play games, but it's almost like blessing in disguise when you do get hurt, that the things that maybe you neglect or don't spend as much time on, you actually get to do a little bit more of that, whether that's on the pitch, in the gym, or like off the pitch doing, you know, an extra study course, or, you know, doing more like mental resilience training and that. So even though it sucks, I'm quite bored at the moment, but it's given me time to like do things that like maybe I haven't or wouldn't have had time for, which I'm kind of grateful that it's almost like you can shift your focus to have a high performance in a different area.
Yeah, I really like that. I always ask our guests to take us back to their childhood. Tell me about Lydia as a little kid and what are kind of some core memories that stick out to you?
Lydia's a little kid. I grew up in the desert. So Kalgoorlie, for nobody that knows, is like red dirt, gold mining capital of Australia. Just pure people flying in and out for mines or people that live there. So, it was just growing up with a lot of family. My dad's family is from there. So learning about Indigenous, traditions and being out traveling in the desert. Then also meeting a lot of friends and being at school. And it was really kind of a nice foundation that it was quite multicultural, my friend group. And what my dad taught me was really immense in Indigenous culture and Aboriginal traditions that we've had. And I've remembered to these days where we'd go out and learn about how to start a fire.
Yeah, right.
How to camp, you know, which berries you can eat and which you can't. So really kind of my childhood was desert life and being Indigenous in the bush.
Am I right in saying that you had two pet kangaroos?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was usually like we had a huge four-wheel drive with a bull bar. So like when we travel in the desert, obviously there's no street lights. It's just the stars, the moon, blackness, and then your car with like its high beams or whatever. So you'd be driving around and, you know, kangaroos would just get attracted to the high beam and, you know, as they do, they just jump out of the middle of nowhere. And so we'd hit them. But we'd always check their pouches to see if they had joeys and two times they did. So we're out in the middle of the desert. So there's no vets around. There's no wires that you can call. Dad knew what to do. You just take a pillowcase, put some like extra blankets in there and hold the pillowcase and they do the whole dive into it as if it was a mother's pouch. And
yeah, wow.
That's kind of like their home. And, back then there was actually, I don't even know if it was vets, but pet stores that carried kangaroo formula or wild animal formula.
Oh, wow.
So we got to have that and kind of rear it up and give it the formula and it just hop around our backyard.
That's awesome. That's very cool. And then what happened once they were fully grown?
Well, it was more when we moved to Canberra when I was 11. So mum and dad found a kangaroo wildlife park that could be looked after and they kind of went in there and got looked after in WA. So, yeah, that they were thriving the last time we heard. I don't know now. That's a long time ago, but, yeah.
That's very cool. What were their names?
I was very creative as a young child. It was the big Eastern Grey. We called her Chambi.
Nice.
And then we had a little rock wallaby, which I named Rocky. So,
great. Yeah. I like it. Yeah. I like it. Where did you first find your love for football or sport more broadly?
It was probably sport and it was probably in Cal on weekends. It was basically a small country town. So all you do on weekends is play sport with your school friends. So it was all school teams and playing t-ball. T-ball was the best.
Yeah, I played t-ball. Yeah. It's great. It's underrated.
Yeah, t-ball was so fun. So fun. You just get so mad when you hit the stand instead of like you'd swing so hard and the stand would flip and the ball would just drop.
Yes. What a game.
Yeah, so it was t-ball, athletics, basketball, then football, AFL with like desert kids and stuff. So
yeah, cool.
I just played everything and I just really enjoyed it. But it wasn't until I moved to Canberra with the family at 11 that most of those sports were non-existent.
Right.
Except basketball and football in a team kind of sense of a registration and something that was on the weekend. So I joined both those sports and then realised I like being outside instead of inside.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And, yeah, what was that the main thing that drew you to football or was there something else about the game that you loved?
I think it was, if anyone's watched me run, everyone's like, good thing you're a goalkeeper and not like a runner. So I think it was like, because I guess I'm always just kind of fallen over, a bit clumsy when I was younger. Now I'm more coordinated.
I feel like you're pretty good.
Now it's deliberate falling over.
Yeah, nice.
But it was just kind of, I fell over a few times in basketball and get, you know, the court burns or, you know, falling on wooden floors. And I just ended up being too short as well for a basketball player. So, yeah, football it was.
And when did you start to realize that you might have had a bit of talent and you might have been able to take it somewhere?
I think it was my mum, really, because it was, I started playing for fun and I didn't know who the Matildas were. There was like nothing like that back in 2000 in any kind of broad media unless you search for it. And obviously it was the beginning of, I think, you know, Facebook was coming in, but no real like internet searches or fan pages or anything like that. So, yeah, I just started enjoying playing and then I got invited to a goalkeeper camp. Ended up being about 30 different goalkeepers, male and female, young players, and the goalkeeper coach used to coach for the Socceroos. And after it, he actually came up to my mum after the whole, you know, weekend of it and was like, out of everyone here, Lydia's going to be, has the most potential to kind of make it. So I think it was actually her getting that feedback that she realised, okay, we need to start investing in her and keep pushing her. Because I remember the first time I went to, I used to train at the AIS with some of the men's players or the boys back then. Now a few of them have played in the A-League and actually Andrew Redmayne was one of my close little goalkeeper colleagues back then and, that's, you know, awesome. Socceroo Matilda.
Yeah,
so it's
cool.
Kind of full circle. But I remember when I first started training with the boys, oh, I'd go home crying because it was just, you didn't get treated like a female, you were treated like a goalkeeper.
Yeah,
so
right.
Their high standards were my high standards. But then my mum would be like, no, it's okay, like, stop crying. Like, you have to go again tomorrow. Like, we're investing in this, we're pushing you. Like, it's hard now, but you're going to keep going because they believe in you. They wouldn't do that otherwise. So it was kind of like a little bit of tough love, but I think it paid off in the end.
Where do you sit reflecting on that? Because it's sometimes this really interesting balance, like when there's the combination of male and female coming together in that environment, which obviously doesn't happen at the elite level in terms of competing against each other. But this balance of you want these female athletes to be given the same opportunities and held to the same standards. Mm-hmm. But yeah, where did that sit with you as a young person where you'd go home and perhaps feel quite emotional and maybe a bit out of your depth in the early days?
Yeah, I think it was kind of hard to take in at the time. But for me, it was no other female was kind of getting that opportunity to play and be a part of, you know, these male footballers who, mind you, they were very, very respectful and awesome, like, guys that, you know, they, if it was a hard shot, they'd take a little bit off. They wouldn't whack it at me, but it would still be the same dynamic movement or exercise that we would go through. So they were really respectful with understanding kind of the power aspect that we're never going to have the same power as, as men. But it was kind of no one else was having that opportunity. So I kind of reached the pinnacle of what was offered for me as a female, young female goalkeeper. And then I was like, okay, what's next? Like, I don't really know. And then it was, you can train with the boys. And these boys might go on to be, you know, Socceroos and A-League and, you know, make all this money and, you know, all this kind of thing. And I was like, okay, yeah. And I was always their equal in that training session. So it was never felt difficult for me. It was probably at the beginning of, you know, the yelling and high demands that, you know, what men do and men say versus like how a female might react to that. So
yeah,
it was
sure.
Very, I had to learn very quickly to take the emotional side out of feedback and in the moment reactions and kind of adjust to that.
Do you notice that there's a specific type of person that becomes a goalkeeper or is it more the skill set?
You mean they're crazy?
I didn't say it. I wanted to ask you the question.
I think it has to be. I think you have to be a little bit crazy in terms of resilience. It's a very lonely position. No one really knows exactly what you're going through unless you're a goalkeeper. Even though you are part of a team and you have a team structure and how you want to play. But when it comes to the actual foundation of being a goalkeeper, it's you are alone in that. And you can see a lot of, they call it the union. I'm sure a lot of other sports have that with specific positions, but it's the goalkeeper union where only goalkeepers actually understand what another is going through in that time. So, I think you have to be really comfortable with being uncomfortable at times and be okay with, I guess, accepting the criticism that comes with it, but also the high praise that can come with it as well. So it's there's never really a happy medium for a goalkeeper. It's really high or it's really low.
Yeah, it is quite interesting, isn't it? You don't often get to sit in that place of just being content or being mediocre. Like there's this real expectation on you there.
Yeah, it's brutal. But, you know, with that, the success is amazing when the team does really well. But, you know, also there's like a big spotlight on you if you make a mistake or something goes wrong. But that's why you have to, I guess, have a good team dynamic throughout with your goalkeeper union and also with your teammates to make sure that it's, you know, you're winning and losing together and you have that support.
Yeah, for sure. Take me back to 17-year-old Lydia, who I believe debuted on the 29th of July in 2005 against Korea Republic.
Yeah, that was we lost that game.
Yep.
Thank you.
No comment on that part. Yeah. What was it like for you? Like, even do you even remember like the preparation and the build up and getting your first jersey? Like, what was it like?
I was thinking, what the heck? I was like, I was in the team for about 6 months before that. I think when I was 16, I made the squad, and just all these like real hardworking women that I was like really intimidated by, because you could see how hard they worked to get where they are and just how much it meant to them, where I was like, oh, yeah, cool. Like, I get to travel the world. This is awesome. And then it was almost like the expectation of like, hey, like, you're actually being here to like playing. Like, it's not just you're here for the ride. It's you're here to play, learn from these women and develop into the player that you're meant to be. And like, you're actually learning to play. So we played a friendly game against a Chinese team earlier that tournament. I think it was like ended up being like a month and a half trip that we went to all the Asian countries. I think it was China, Japan, ended in South Korea. And it was just a friendly, and like, China were the world champions the year before, I'm pretty sure. So they, just for the friendly of a club team, they just packed out the stadium, which was, you know, like 5,000 people. But I was like, this is wild. This is, my gosh, just for a club team? And so I think we ended up losing that game. And that was my first time in goal with these women, and just the encouragement that I felt from them of like, we have to give this kid an actual go. Like, there's a reason why she's here. She's been around, like, it's development. Like, let's support her through that. And so I was like, okay, we've got through the end. And then the last game, we're all over it. It's like, been in Asia for too long. Everyone wanted to go home. The time when there was no Wi-Fi and, you know, we didn't have phones that connected to the internet. So you're calling your parents from hotel phones. Like, it was just, you know, nothing. And here I am. Here you go. Here's your debut against the Korean team, who were really good. And it was pouring down rain, and we're in like kind of this like change room that didn't really have chairs. We kind of put all our stuff on the side and you're sitting around or standing. And we lost 3-0, but I remember, you know, coming in and everyone just congratulating me. And I was like, but we lost. Like, you know, I was excited. I got my first cap, but I'm like, we lost. But like, no, it's really like, welcome. Like, now it's time to like actually work.
Yeah.
Like, you're a part of the team now. Like, it's no longer your little, you know, grace period of, oh, this is fun. It's like, hey, you're a part of, this is the taste of what it is at international football. Welcome to the team. Get ready to start working. So, yeah, a little bit same, like, of tough love. Like, okay, well done, Lydia. You got your first cap. Awesome. Let's go home. But guess what? Like, now you're going to have to start, like, digging your heels in and let's start, like, going and really kind of pushing yourself.
And what does digging your heels in for you look like? What did that journey look like for you to have an incredible career that you've had to date?
To be honest, I had to be knocked down a few rungs throughout my career a little bit. I think the first club I went to was overseas, ended up being Chicago. And I was like, this is sick. I'm a 20 years old going overseas for the first time. Not many people were going overseas. I was going as a number two to learn mostly. And yeah, I just thought that like, oh yeah, I've made it. Like I'm going overseas. That's like the end goal.
Mm.
And I got a big reality check when I was over in the States with the players that we had playing around and just how far I had to go to even get a sniff at that level.
Wow.
Like the goalkeeper that was in with me in front of me as a number one, played at two Olympics, won a silver medal, an amazing person, Swedish goalkeeper. And like I was just like, okay, like here I am, young and sprightly, like being able to do all these things. And, you know, she's having like more massages and rest days. Now I know what that's like and why you need it. But I was like, oh, no, like I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
Then when it came to performance, I was miles off it.
Yeah.
So it was really kind of a big reality check of like, you know, you're doing really well and you have all these opportunities, but yeah, you're not as good as like what you need to be at the next level. So that really, being in America really kind of made me realize like I need to do extra gym. I need to do extra running. I need to make sure that I'm doing my ice baths, that I need to get input from the fitness coach and the S&C, not just the goalkeeper coach, ask questions to the coach of like how we want to play. And so it was really kind of like you're not, even though you're in a team and you just have, you know, maybe one coach, you have to utilize everything and everyone.
Yeah, wow. Were there certain moments in Chicago or for any of the clubs that you've played with in those early days where, whether it was something on field where you felt like you had a moment of like, okay, we're making a step here, like that stuff is starting to pay off and you could feel your confidence build from that?
Yeah, it's actually when in Chicago we – the team was quite young. Out on paper, we were like, it was like Megan Rapinoe, Christian, Karen Carney, Ella Massa, all these young players that were there.
It's a pretty cool lineup.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had like Carly Lloyd, like.
That's insane.
Tarps. We had so many people in this team. It was amazing. And just how much we kind of, the vibe was so good of taking on the young ones as well as the old ones, and it was a real nice mesh of people and team. And it was when we would play, it was like young players against everyone else, and it was just like you could kind of see it then, like the change of dynamic of like what the younger players were bringing into what the next ended up being the next generation of superstars or footballing culture of what that looked like. You can just see the flair of it versus the hardworking, you know, the older ones have already established of what they've done to get where they are. So, yeah, it was like around then when I started to, at the end of it, when I started to understand, you know, how the differences were, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but how you kind of mesh and get information from older players but also learn and develop through, you know, your own journey and young players.
Now that you're the player that gets extra massages, I hope.
Yep.
I feel like you've earned that.
100%.
How has your experience over those years shaped how you now treat the younger players that come in?
Yeah, it's intimidating now. Now it's, you have social media, you have, you know, more pressure from the outside. There's almost like more of an expectation as a young player. We were kind of lucky coming in. The majority of us came in when maybe social media was just starting.
Yeah.
So, you know, for the likes of myself, Emily Van Egmon, Sam, Caitlin, Steph, like we all came in at this era where like social media just started beginning. And the Matildas were just starting to, you know, have this run. Where now, gosh, I'd like, you're coming into a high profile, high performance environment where really it's all eyes on you, if whoever you are. when you come on, eyes on you, like media wise, eyes on you on the pitch performance, eyes on you at training, at meetings. So for me, it's like, how do I help people that come in to feel comfortable and to kind of ease them into what the pressure might be? And I guess, you know, just talking is such a powerful tool for anybody. You don't think that you need to give information, but just talking and making people feel comfortable, that's almost more than enough to help them in that journey.
Yeah, so the social media element, and you kind of touched on that for your debut, the change room standards and things like that. What do you reflect on now? And we caught up recently at the World Players Association conference to kind of reflect on the history of women's sport and looking ahead to the future. What are some of the stark differences between the recent World Cup and your debut and your first World Cup?
Oh, first of all, it's like, you know, the amount of support you have from federation, the backing of which is equates to money, which then gets distributed into like player payments, professionalism, high performance standards, staff, coaching. So obviously that's a major difference where we're on, you know, basically equal terms with what the men are, which is incredible for us. But obviously, like, it's only small in the spectrum of like how long it's taken to get to that point and where we need to go as well. But yeah, you know, it's just everything from having, you know, the little, what do you even call them? Like barbecue chairs that you, the plastic ones you get from like Kmart or Bunnings that, you know, that you have them in the change room versus now we have these like seats that like Ferrari has like endorsed and like they're proper leather seats that you can like, you know, you change it. Some of them in Europe, they're heated.
Because I'm playing the wrong sport.
Like literally, like everyone else is out in the rain and like stadiums in Europe will have a stand over the subs bench and heated seats.
Wow.
And like even cup holders, you put, you know, your drink bottle there or like whatever you're having. Like it's, and they're padded.
Beautiful. Like,
so
you might prefer to sit on the bench.
Literally, you go sometimes. From like, you know, Bunnings seats to like Ferrari endorsed like seats. It's like crazy.
Yeah, that's cool.
So like even just from that, you're like, wow. Like just being a part of what men's stadiums and cultures already had is like, it's new, but it's not new to football.
When we caught up at that PA event, you're also involved with the Football Players Association as well. Can you talk a little bit about your role and why it is important for you to have a voice in that space?
Yeah, it started off as me just being a part of, you know, the, I guess the PFA Players Union just as a representative and then went into like a leadership group and then went into the exec role, which I've had for a long time. And then now with, I guess, the changing of the guard with the new CBA and everything, we've decided to have a president and vice president, one being a male, which is Jackson, and me being vice president to represent the whole game. And it was really important, I think, for the PFA to show the solidarity with both equal male and female representation. So, yeah, really it's kind of a bit more of a stronger voice, I think, that, you know, having someone who's directly involved in what the high performance male footballing team is and then the high performance female footballing team is have direct lines to, you know, the CEOs and how we want to shape the sport and what it needs. And so it's really high detailed, I guess, things that need to be in discussion and have decisions on. That's kind of where both Jackson and I will come involved in kind of making these really, I guess, big decisions, but it's been endorsed by the players and been endorsed by the representation from, you know, both the Matildas and Socceroos.
Yeah, there's been some incredible ground made in those CBAs. What were some of the key things you were pushing for as a playing group from the women's side of things?
Oh, it's always been, you know, having support staff, like to, when you see a head coach, and especially a head coach in the male game at a club, they'll have maybe three different assistants, and you just need that. I mean, sometimes that coach might not have expertise in, you know, some other kind of area. And so you need to have another coach there, where before it was we only had one or two. So it was really making sure that whatever the men decide that they need, we have the opportunity to have that same decision made for us. Now, obviously, it's, you know, money, and about, I think the biggest thing we did was changing RCBA from contracts, which were year-round, to now having player payments, which we wanted to make it a reward-based system, because the thing with football is that, you know, basically you spend, I think I said it was like 70 or 80% of your time is spent with club.
Right.
As a footballing career,
mm-hmm.
our actual bulk of our time is spent with club.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that pay you per month, per year. You have your gym access there. It's everything that you do away from football is, or from national team, is with your club. So we really wanted to make the national team be high performance. So you come in, you're not injured. you're ready to go if you need to be called upon. And it's also cutthroat. You have to perform now. You have to leave a lasting impression to get called back in.
Mm.
So, you know, that's where it's like you have more pressure on you to perform and do what you need to do outside of national team. But when you come in, here's your reward. We're getting the same payment as what the men do. This is what basically how most national teams actually function now.
Right, okay. Was there a bit of back and forth making that decision about which route to go down? Because it does definitely add another level of pressure.
Yeah, I think it was majority of everyone felt it was the right decision. It was, I think, just more the timing
mm-hmm.
of when. And I think, you know, doing the numbers and doing brainstorming as a group and having our leadership group really knuckle down issues and what they want the lasting impression of the Matildas to be. Doing those kind of workshops really kind of said it's either now or never, really.
Yeah.
And so at first it was really scary, but, you know, at the end of the day, it is, we want it to be high performance, and that's, you know, you get called in, great, keep your spot then.
Mm.
So that's kind of where we want that expectation to be of you do all your work that you need to do at clubland, and then when you come in to national team, it's always, we have to win. That's literally what it is.
Yeah, it's go time.
It's how you get things.
Yeah, yeah. I love watching the way that goalkeepers run the show, like the amount that you guys are just like, obviously you've got the vision and the amount that you guys are talking and telling people where to go, and like it's quite amazing to see. Do you feel like you always had those natural leadership qualities, or do you feel like that's something you developed throughout your career?
Oh, absolutely not. No one believes me when I say this, but like I was so shy.
Wow.
I was so shy as a kid. And especially when I started actually taking the goalkeeping role, it was when I moved from Kalgoorlie to Canberra.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know anyone. I was a shy kid. I was meeting people at like a new school. I was joining up a new team. I was being a goalkeeper, and I was like, okay, cool. I thought we're rotating, but don't worry. Like, I'm just going to stay here.
Mm.
So there was all these new things that was happening that I was like, okay, well, I'm terrified. And then it wasn't until I started having a goalkeeper coach that would just tell me, just talk.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I don't care what you talk about. Like, I don't care if you just yell out like left, right, like, and it's the wrong thing. He's like, we just need to get you to talk
right.
in games. So he's literally like, pass, there, head, like, up. Like, it was ridiculous. Like,
but you did it? Like, you bought into it?
Yeah. It's just like, I just need you to talk. And I'm like, I don't care how stupid you sound. I know you might, but like, I'm letting you know, you just have to start talking about just anything. And then when you're comfortable with just talking, now we're going to refine it to specific actions and specific words and higher up the pitch and what you see. And so it really just started out with, Lydia, you just need to chat.
Just say something.
Say something. I don't care what it is. Just yell
louder.
Like, you know, it would be like louder. Okay, less. And so it really was kind of a like training like how to speak properly.
Mm. It's interesting because I think even with us, like in footy, when we sometimes have the young kids come in who are, they've just been drafted, they don't feel like they've really earned their spot yet, and they can often be really quiet. And sometimes you say to them, like, just say whatever. Like, but the fact that it sounded like that coach was really invested and genuinely kind of followed along each of those steps to make it happen rather than just being like, just say something and then walking away and focusing on something else.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the quality and kind of the good thing that we have with football is that as a goalkeeper, you literally only have one coach with you and maybe like two other players.
Yeah.
So really you are all that focuses, that coach is on you.
Mm.
So really a specific, they can really narrow it down and really refine what they need from you because they don't have to watch the rest of the game. They can literally stand there and like watch you. And then, like, something's happening up there, and they can just be like, higher, you need to stand higher.
Yeah, right.
Like, start talking.
Yeah.
Come to the left, like, you're not in line. So, really, okay. They can do all that stuff.
Have you always been good at taking on feedback? Because I feel like you'd be getting a lot of feedback if that's the case.
Yeah, yes and no. I've had to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, I had to have my rungs hit down a little bit for me to kind of understand, like, this person's helping me. I've always been pretty stubborn, so it's taken me a while to know that you can learn a bit of feedback from everything that someone says, even if it's really negative. Maybe they're having a bad day, so maybe it's how you approach them. Like, maybe it's like you don't actually agree with what they're saying, or they're wrong.
Mm.
But maybe that's just they're frustrated. So how can you help them in their frustration of what they're saying? And then maybe having a conversation after.
Mm.
Now, the amount of conversations that actually happen at halftime or when a ball goes out, like you don't really see it if you're not on the pitch. But, you know, it might be, you know, that was a wrong call. You needed to come for that. Yeah, I know. Next time I'll make sure. Can we just make sure that I know that player and you can shuffle around? Yeah, and then it's done.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's so many conversations that are happening outside of, like, what's being seen on the pitch. But, yeah, I think it's you can learn something from everyone, even if it is positive or negative.
Yeah, I like that. Can we take a look at the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup?
Sure.
What was the...
Sure.
Like, are you sick of talking about it yet?
Nah, it's still pretty cool. It's still pretty cool.
What was the lead up to that tournament like for you?
To be honest, the amount of, like, I think we've always had such a tight-knit group. Like, from the get-go, everyone's just been so tight in the group of protecting what we're building. Protecting the outside noise, and just kind of making sure that the focus was like internal, never external, never anything but the team. And I think a couple of our results leading into the year up to 23, the media was not nice sometimes.
Yeah.
With a couple of our results, like we were obviously like still developing a style, still developing players. And I think, you know, if everyone's expecting consistency or just like, yeah, like, look at all this, but we were really developing and still understanding, like, it takes a long journey for when a new coach comes in and a style of play and leading into a tournament of different teams you're going to play, how to, like, understand, especially when you're only together 20% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of hard work when you go into camp of like how quickly can you adjust to what this load and these information is versus like when you're away. So leading into it, we're all very like, okay, we need to stick together. Like there's no doubt about it. All this outside noise or whatever, it doesn't mean anything. Let's stick together. And then we got obviously to the tournament and the build up to it, everyone felt really good, really sharp. Like the amount of sport science and tactical, technical information that went into it. You could tell it was a lot. Like there was a lot of information we had to do, a lot of different tactics we had to learn, gym, double days, recovery. Like we were just basically at the Gold Coast for a month leading into when we went into camp for the World Cup. And the amount of work that we did was for the finals.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew that we weren't going to peak until probably around quarters, or like the round of 16 into quarters. That's when our peak would be, hopefully peaking, like continuing with that form.
Mm.
And then, yeah, we got to the first game and it was, I think we were all nervous because of what it meant. So you could kind of see on everyone's face when Steph scored the pen, just like you could almost feel like the weight drop off like everything, because it was just like, okay, here we go. This is the first game. Like we need to win.
Mm.
It's not the end of the world if we don't, because then we'll go one game at a time. But like the significance of the first game, it was, yeah, we need to win this. And after that, it just felt like there was just no doubt, if that makes sense. Like when we got to the penalty shootout, now everyone else was like looking away, but everyone just felt, it was weird. Everyone felt calm, like on the sideline. I'm sure the girls felt calm when they were lining up at the halfway line, but it was just like this sense of like, it's going to be okay, which is weird.
Yeah. What do you think contributed to that sense of calm?
I think we just all believed in each other.
Mm.
The amount of like, honestly, the amount of penalties we ended up practicing. I think my shoulder was like dead by the end of it, like practicing with the girls, but like the practice it until they were confident. So it was literally like got to the point when we're in, you know, match day minus ones, whatever anyone needed to do to be confident, do it.
Mm.
Don't care what it is. Like do a small warm up, 10 minutes, whatever you need, then do whatever you need to do to feel confident going into that game.
Yeah, nice.
So a lot of it was self-responsibility and self, I guess, like how do you prepare the best as a team or the best by yourself? And a lot of it as we went on was make sure you are, that like we can't do any more tactics. We have no time.
Mm.
So whatever you need as an individual, do it.
And that World Cup, I'd love to know how you felt when you're actually selected in that group, because you and Claire Polkinghorne, were you the first Aussies to hit the 5 World Cup milestone?
Yeah, like men and women. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. How did that feel?
I mean, it always feels good to be selected in a national team. I think me and Polks have learned to be very humble, that we are very lucky and very blessed in the position that we have been. And yeah, I think it got to a point, I think, when Polks ended up getting, what was it, like the highest capped Australian footballer. And she was like, I'm sick of my parents getting flown here. Like, I'm sick of my family seeing them all the time for like to celebrate something else. She's like, I don't have to celebrate anything else. I got the oh my gosh, what did she get? The highest cap, the longest something else. I'm like,
okay. Just all the milestones.
Yeah, literally all the milestones Polks got. And she's just like, yeah, it's over. And we're still excited for her.
Mm.
So yeah, it felt great, but also it felt like if anything was going to happen, it was going to be this World Cup. And for that for me was probably even bigger than any of the other ones that I've been selected in, because it was like home World Cup. Who would have thought? Everyone's going to watch football. Who would have thought? Like, I get to be here with these girls that I've known for 10 plus years, like who would have thought? So for me, it was like, oh, I was just really thankful. And I guess it was just kind of validating, or like a cherry on the top of like just what my career has been.
Mm. What did it feel like for you in terms of contributing? Because you obviously didn't get to contribute how I imagine you would have liked to as much on the field, but I have no doubt that you would have contributed a huge amount in a leadership capacity off field. What was that like for you, that process?
Yeah, I think when you kind of get at the end of your career, like twilight years, you know what your limitations and capabilities are. And leading into the tournament, I was very well aware of kind of where I was sitting in the fold. And then it turned to Macca's been, you know, my goalkeeper understudy for, gosh, 10 years now, eight, 10 years. And to kind of see that journey of hers, for me, it was like, cool, like, I need to throw everything I can into, like, this and making sure, like, this is not me wanting to play, this is us wanting to win.
Mm.
And so it was kind of, like, humbling in a way of, like, understanding my role, but I've had, like, a few years to kind of process it and not be upset if I don't play.
Mm.
But then now cherishing every time that I do play.
Yeah.
Because I don't really know how long's left. So it kind of goes from like you it's almost like you start and you're like, I'm so happy to be playing. And then it goes, I need to play.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you get to the end, it has to change to I'm so happy to be playing again. Because if it stays there, then you get bitter.
Yeah, wow. It almost like comes full circle.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, yeah, it's really quite interesting. There was a photo captured of you, I think, by some fans at the end of that last game in Brisbane of you sitting against the goalpost. Do you remember what was going through your head at that point in time?
I was bawling. Oh. I was crying my eyes out.
Oh.
It was just the full circle. It was being there in COVID when we won the bid was, like, insane. And the stuff, like, of COVID, like, just how it disrupted the whole world, the whole sporting world. And, like, just knowing that we actually did it, we got that far as we did, and the heartbreak of not leaving with anything, but just knowing what we've done for the country and what the team has achieved. And it was just, you know, it was the last time I'd probably be on the pitch of a World Cup as a player. So it was really kind of just like taking it all in of like, you know, this is my last World Cup. Like last one with these girls, we didn't win anything, but what we've done is incredible. So it was kind of like a mix of like every emotion. And I just wanted to kind of sit with that for a bit, just to, you know, that you don't really get that many moments, I think, in your career, especially as you get close to retirement, where you really get to sit with feelings.
Mm.
A lot of like an athlete's career is dusted off. We have the next thing.
Yes.
And you actually don't have much time to sit with the feeling.
Mm.
And I decided just wanted to sit with it for a little bit because it was so incredible and I didn't know, am I ever going to get something like that again? So, yeah, it was heartbreaking. But then, yeah, I think Macca was the first one that came running over to me and she, well, you, what's happening? Why are you here? Why are you crying? But, it was just, I just wanted to sit with it.
Mm. What was it like as a playing group, because obviously the whole country, for those who weren't already in love with you, the whole country then fell in love with you. I felt like so much of the attention was you guys breaking barriers and changing attitudes and doing all of these incredible things, but not as much focus on the fact that you guys are like the elite of the elite and you perform to the highest level under immense pressure and scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't feel like that was appreciated enough.
Yeah.
Did it feel like that as players?
I think we just think of each other as friends and teammates. And I think the way that we've been portrayed, which is amazing, is that we're so accessible.
Mm.
And anyone can dream to be a Matilda. Like, it's not like we have all these bodyguards around us or, you know, we're not going out and meeting, you know, communities and the public or spending time to sign things. Like, we're making deliberate decisions to be accessible and be people can dream to be a Matilda.
Mm.
But yeah, it's the stuff that you don't see. I think the documentary explained it really well with Ellie and her ACL injury, just how much hard work she put into then being where she is. And a lot of it actually doesn't get shown. Like the amount of work that Sam did to get back to playing in those games at the World Cup. But I think that's something that we, as a group, it's celebrated within the group, but I think sometimes we just want to keep it there. You know, it would be nice to kind of show just how hard we really work. But a lot of it is, you know, it is our bubble. It's our personal thing. That's like the hard work. We can joke and relax when we're in front of a camera or meeting people, but when it comes to hard work, like, we don't care if the cameras are there. Doesn't bother us.
Mm.
So I think a lot of what has been captured and what has people seen has been what we allow, where the hard work is like sacred to what we do.
Yeah, wow.
I think.
Yeah, really interesting. Looking ahead, you've still got time left, but what do you hope your legacy will be that you leave on the game? And just touching on the two kids' books that you've released, which is epic, and even the fact that you've been inducted into the Aboriginal and Islander Sports Hall of Fame, like what do you hope when you leave the game, hopefully in a few years' time?
Yeah.
What's the legacy you hope to leave?
Oh, I think, to be honest, I think AFL do it really well with Indigenous kids and, you know, bringing Indigenous athletes into the mainframe and the big leagues. And I would love to see football do that. I was really lucky that, you know, to be honest, unless we move from Kalgoorlie to Canberra, I probably would have had a different path in life. But I think inspiring Indigenous kids to dream to be a Matilda, like you can see there's, you know, Ellie from Cowra, Mary from Cairns, me and Cal. Then you get, you know, like Steph's from here in Melbourne, Sam's from Perth, like we're from everywhere, from big towns, small towns, cities, playing overseas, playing at home. And it, I would love to see, you know, just so many, it is the world game. Like it needs to be shared with everyone. And I think going out into Indigenous communities and really promoting football, I think, is the next step that I would like to be involved with. But I want, you know, I want every World Cup to be the Matildas are in top four. And that's a work in progress. That's hard work, both on and off the field and behind the scenes. And yeah, that's more investment. That's more players going overseas, more players doing, you know, whatever they can to get in the right environment that they need to be. So I think that still has a while to go because we have the rest of the world to that are playing catch up and chasing or leading the way. Like it's not just, you know, in Australia, it's like you have to see what Spain are doing. You have to see what Japan are doing, what America are doing, and how do you get that and replicate it to an Australian standard and it's what Australians, their DNA, how they produce the same results as what an American would do or, you know, a French player would do. And yeah, it's kind of, it's weird. It's like how do you morph to your own culture and country, your own identity, but also taking bits and pieces from different countries and what they're doing.
Yeah, to keep striving to be in that top four.
Yeah.
The challenge.
Yeah, they see bolters like Colombia. I had no idea like they were going to be that good.
Yeah.
And then,
awesome.
You know, Germany's usually up there all the time. So it's like, oh man, what are they doing?
Yeah.
So then you're like, okay, well, that's something that came out of nowhere. So what are they doing to then us needing to do this to make sure that we stay ahead of them?
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, it's really interesting.
I love it. I love that. Thank you so much for your time today. I've loved chatting to you and just even learning from you. You've just got a very gentle presence and I can see the way that you've really reflected on a whole range of different things that you've learned throughout your career, and it's been a real privilege to sit down and chat with you.
Oh, thank you. I'll be more than welcome to come back whenever.
Amazing. Cool. Thank you so
much. Thank you,
Sue. Thanks so much for listening. If you got something out of this episode, I would absolutely love it if you could send it on to one person who you think might enjoy it. Otherwise, subscribe, give us a review, and make sure you follow us on Instagram at The Female Athlete Project to stay up to date with podcast episodes, merch drops, and of course, news and stories about epic female athletes.